Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today. You know, I'm noticing a theme the last few months, maybe since the end of last year, where I'm trying to figure out how we got here, how we got to where we are in 2021 with our food system, especially. I've noticed, I've looked back to some of the people I've spoken with over the year. Maybe you remember, I interviewed Carolyn Cobbold, who wrote A Rainbow Palette, How Chemical Dyes Changed the West's Relationship with Food. Remember that one? Or Chris Otter talking about Diet for a Large Planet, Industrial Britain, Food Systems and World Ecology, or Wendy Wollison's Crap, A History of Cheap Stuff in America. All of these dug really deep into history and how we got to where we are today. And there was always a thread that was similar in all of these things, how we allowed poisons into our food system and how we exploited people all over the world to bring specific foods to our plate. Even with the books about vanilla and saffron, every food has its own unique story and a lot of it is ugly. Today, we're going to continue on this theme of how we got to where we are today. And we're going to focus on the plant-based vegan food movement and how far we have strayed. And to do that, to help me with this brainstorming or this conversation on where we are and how we got here, I am bringing on with me an old friend and colleague, Michelle Simon. And she has a long, phenomenal bio, and I recommend that you read it on the page that goes with this interview. But just her short tag, which I really love. Michelle is an author, food policy expert, founder, and troublemaker. And I think what I like most about Michelle is that she tells the truth and she tells you what's on her mind, period. And I think, because I've experienced this a lot, people may not like you for that. Mm-hmm. So with that, Michelle, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Karen, for having me. That's a great intro. Tell people how people don't like me. But yeah, you're right. Being a truth teller can be a lonely job at times, for sure.
I like you.
Yeah, thank you.
Because you tell the truth, but I know how difficult it is. Well, it's not hard to tell the truth, but the reactions can be just amazing.
Yes, that is true. I mean, it is interesting that truth telling is even like, something unusual or something that we have to kind of elevate and celebrate. Why aren't we all truth tellers? Right? I mean, why is it so hard to tell the truth? Obviously, a lot of ways we can unpack that, but I appreciate your identifying me that way. I am very proud of being a truth teller.
Yes, you should be. You know, when I leave this planet, I want to know I'm leaving with my integrity.
Right.
Because what else is there?
What else do we have? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some truth. And let's start at our beginning. So I want to know a little bit more about you and how you got to where you are today, specifically with veganism, which is maybe not the right word because we have to be careful about labeling, but plant foods versus animal foods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd love to start with some background because it helps set the stage for our conversation. So I discovered food in the mid-90s before really there was much of a food movement, and really was inspired at first by books by the likes of Dean Ornish and the sort of health reasons to adopt a vegetarian diet, and then was pretty blown away by John Robbins' book, A Diet for Food in America. And you know, I had already been to public health school and law school, and you know, nobody taught me about any of this stuff in either of those places. And then, so that set me sort of on a, you know, personal journey of shifting my diet to plant-based. And then I actually started volunteering with the local Earth Save chapter in San Francisco. And that kind of really plugged me into a really strong community of like-minded people, and many of whom I'm still friends with today. So That was kind of on the personal side. And then professionally, what really inspired me was discovering the work of Marion Nestle. So it's, you know, now maybe 96, 97. And back then, she wasn't the well-known author that she is today. She was simply writing academic articles about fascinating topics like how the meat and dairy industries influence the dietary guidelines and school food. And I mean, I was pretty blown away by this and then realized, oh, this sounds like a path that I want to follow to really connect the dots between how it is that the standard American diet became so focused on animal products when the science clearly dictated otherwise. And, you know, really no surprise that that is all really a function of political influence and our economic system that is based on promoting meat, egg, and dairy products over the healthier plant-based foods that we all know and love. So that really is where I started my path of researching and writing about the food industry and combining it with this personal passion to promote a vegan diet. You know, somewhere in there though, because the field wasn't really very developed, especially in the vegan movement, which was largely focused on education and potlucks, frankly. And that was just not really how I wanted to, I mean, you know, I met some nice people at potlucks, but it didn't strike me as a very sort of politically oriented, you know, activity. So I wouldn't want to say I left the vegan food movement, but I broadened my perspective, and as you have, on all things food. And that really kind of was very important in my understanding about the food industry in general, right? Not just the meat and dairy industries that are undermining public policy, but the entire food industry. And so that's what led me to write my book in 2006 called Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back, and really shining a light on the underhanded public relations tactics and lobbying tactics of the likes of McDonald's and Coca-Cola and Kraft and the rest. And that was, you know, really important era there in the 2000s when the food movement was finally kind of finding its footing. And I got, you know, I felt like people kind of caught up to me and said, oh yeah, you're right, Michelle, it is political. Guess what? It's all politics. So, you know, it's been a good ride. I worked on a number of issues, junk food marketing to children, GMO labeling, I got very involved with around 2012, 2013. And all the while learning about, you know, how corporations operate. And then kind of got a little burned out, I think, of complaining all the time about the evildoers. And, you know, was really watching sort of this next wave, if you will, of vegan companies come along that were really trying to push the envelope and not just appeal to the relatively small niche market of vegans and vegetarians, but wanted to go mainstream. And were finding themselves with some regulatory challenges, shall we say, with how to label their products. And Miyoko's was actually the first company that came to my attention. I had been friends with Miyoko Shinner in the Bay Area for many years. And so we were just chatting at a lovely dinner at Millennium Restaurant one day in fall of 2014. And she was saying how she was, you know, dealing with the state of California and its silly regulatory, you know, pushback on her using the word cheese on her lovely organic cashew cheese products. And so I said, well, that's dumb. We should form a trade group. That's what trade groups do. They fight stupid laws, and there's nothing wrong with lobbying against stupid laws. It just should be done for the right reasons. And so that was my inspiration for then spending, really the following year to launch the Plant-Based Foods Association, which is the nation's first and only trade group representing plant-based food companies. And so through that, I really understood the business side and then left that organization at the end of last year. And so I've really been spending the last few months kind of reflecting on, as you said, sort of, you know, even my own origins in the movement. And kind of how far we've come and what's changed. And so I'll pause there. There's a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. I mean, I have the image in my mind of you and Miyoko at the Millennium strategizing, talking about industry problems and coming up with a direction and comparing that. My career origins start in the Bay Area in Silicon Valley. And there are these stories we always were told about how all of these negotiations happened in certain restaurants with high-powered white men. And I'm enjoying the contrast of these two images in a vegan restaurant with these two amazing women versus this other image of the wheeling and dealing.
Right, right. And the difference being that we didn't decide to launch a tech company. We decided, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but Miyoko has created a really amazing business. In fact, I don't eat pizza very often. I'm consider myself a whole food plant eater. And occasionally I'll indulge. And we discovered here in California, where we're staying for a while, that Pizza My Heart has a plant-based vegan pizza with Miyoko's cheese and field roast sausage. And we had it last night and it was really pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is really great to have those options available now that we never did before. I joke about how, you know, back in the early days, do you remember when we had to I joke about it. It wasn't quite like this. We had to put your hand in the tub of tofu. the tofu that was swimming in a tub of water in the natural food store. And that was it, so we've come a long way since then.
We have. And there's good with it and some not so good. And I think we'll focus probably more on the not so good, but maybe we'll focus on the good too, because it's a good thing to do. Okay, so here we are. And one thing that has been driving me crazy is the use of plant-based today in 2021. And it has evolved over, at least since the 90s. I don't know when this term was originally coined and who coined it, but when I was with EarthSave, a lot of our articles used plant-based in it. And I was always wondering, what does this really mean? Because we were promoting a vegan diet, a diet void of animal products. And plant-based had, it was like a softer sell somehow.
Right.
But there's two ways that you can go with plant-based. Plant-based could mean based in plants, all plants, or it could mean that maybe the bulk of it is plants, and then you can sprinkle into it whatever else and not worry about it. And I think we've gone with that second definition, or we're seeing it a lot more. And then that sprinkle of animals has just gotten a little out of hand. What do you think?
Well, there's actually many more than two ways to use the phrase, and not all of them good. You're right. So the way I think about it is in a couple of different ways. And I had certainly got asked quite a bit, and having created the Plant-Based Foods Association, about that phrase. And I think there, for some who are maybe more, recent followers of the movement, there is this idea out there that it's just sort of this marketing phrase that got made up a couple of years ago. And that is absolutely not true. And as you say, I mean, I remember very clearly that EarthSave, probably was among the first to adopt the phrase. And I definitely resonated with it, myself, gravitating towards a vegan lifestyle per se, but for me, it was always about the food. And so I liked this idea of also helping people shift towards a plant-based diet was a phrase that really resonated with me. And then I totally got from EarthSave. And so it's also interesting to me, there's this other idea in the movement now that, reducing meat is somehow new, when, we were talking about that as far as I went back into the 90s and probably before, plenty of people were talking about reducing meat consumption. And so, so the phrase plant-based was meant to be a kind of gentler way of talking about food, because vegan can have a lot of other meanings. It can be polarizing for people, et cetera. So, but the origins of the phrase were really around real food. right? So a plant-based diet. I think it was really about helping people shift away from an animal-centered diet towards a plant-based diet, which basically means incorporating more whole foods, right? Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, right? The health-promoting foods that we knew were really optimal for a healthy diet. That was definitely the concept. I think over time, the phrase certainly has gotten adopted. Hold off on the co-optation for a minute, but let's just say adopted for many of the right reasons. I, you know, again, having created this association, and we were very deliberate, the board members who came together, of course, we had a whole conversation about what to call this new association. And I mean, I remember Miyoko in particular saying that plant-based has become the phrase to help distinguish products like hers in the marketplace from an animal-based product, right? And so that was really the thinking behind using the phrase plant-based and the plant-based food association was to say, and there was even a decision, again, by the leadership, because it's a membership organization. I didn't make the decisions, the members did. That we wanted to focus on what could be termed alternatives to conventional dairy products. So plant-based foods, of course, can mean anything from quinoa to lettuce to bananas. But we weren't the Quinoa, Lettuce, and Banana Association, right? Produce was already well represented. It was really, again, for the association purposes, to focus on the alternatives because they needed the most help, frankly, and were not represented in the political sphere. So I think, you know, I take full responsibility for helping to attach the phrase plant-based to these alternative foods. And that's what was happening in the marketplace. Okay, like still good, right?
Right. Very good. Okay. I was very excited when it all happened.
Thank you. All right. So now let's get to kind of the darker side of the use of the phrase. And it is true, and I certainly was in a position to defend this criticism, that a lot of the foods, you know, in the plant-based arena, shall we say, are heavily processed. And so, you know, then the critique started coming up, well, you know, plant-based is now being used kind of to mean healthy because, you know, it's being attached to some arguably very processed products. And, well, I would say, well, look, I never said that this was the only definition of the word plant-based, right? And again, for me, there's a plant-based diet, there's shifting to a more plant-based diet, and then there's how do we use the phrase on a food package, right? Which is already processed because it's in a package and not a fresh vegetable. So I think to me, that's an important distinction. Like, sure, someone can eat a plant-based diet. And frankly, if someone thinks a plant-based diet means a base of plants and they sprinkle some meat on it, like that's their prerogative. Like there is really not a super clear definition of plant-based. And, you know, we can argue about whether there should be in that context, but in the food packaging, marketing, labeling context, as a lawyer, there damn well be a definition and it damn well means something. And so we were very clear that for the association's purposes, that plant-based essentially meant vegan in the sense that it meant zero animal products. So one of my pet peeves is when I hear certain vegans look down on the phrase plant-based because as if it's somehow inferior and that there's no definition. Well, there is a definition and I know because I helped create it and definitely meant no animal products. Wanted to make that super clear. Mm-hmm. It also was, actually, I always felt like it was vegan plus because vegan can just mean the absence of animal products, right? But for us, plant-based means actually made from plants, right? So affirmatively plant-based, it's a celebration of plants, right? Whether they're cashews, quinoa, whatever the base of the product is. So it is defined and it does have meaning, at least as far as, you know, I'm concerned. Again, for the express purpose of how it's used on labels. Okay, now let's get back to the dark side. The problem is it is true that plant-based has taken on a bit of a health halo in the marketplace. And perhaps some of that is unfortunate and not always true. However, plant-based can mean different things. And again, if it simply means no animal products, it doesn't have to be health promoting to be plant-based. So, you know, again, for me, there's different contexts. But where it's really gone off the rails is now, because of course the phrase has become a popular marketing term, inevitably it is getting co-opted by the wrong players in the food industry. And so we're seeing, for example, the previous iteration of Tyson's release of what they were calling plant-based products were not in fact 100% plant-based. So they put out a chicken nugget product, for example, that uses egg whites. Mm-hmm. And while, of course, the ingredient panel said that it contained eggs, their marketing messaging all around it was plant-based. And so, you know, I hooked up with an attorney colleague and we threatened to sue Tyson over that. And that's just, you know, inevitable. It happens in the marketplace all the time, whether it's, you know, organic or natural, what have you. Terms are going to get co-opted. Corporations are going to misuse it. Tyson has since reformulated, interestingly enough, and come out with a new line of, 100% plant-based products because they realized they made a mistake. So that's how the marketplace corrects itself. But of course, you know, not every company has corrected itself. There are still others on the market wildly deceiving the public with the phrase plant-based, even though the products do contain some animal ingredients. The other way it's being misused, and I refer to all of this as plant washing, by the way. The other way I'm seeing it is just on stupid products, you know, where it's irrelevant that it's plant-based. So, you know, the other decision that we made in creating the certification is that we didn't want the phrase plant-based just to be used on anything that just, you know, by accident is plant-based, like bananas. So
like they do with gluten-free, with foods that naturally don't have gluten.
Totally. And actually, it's funny you mentioned that because the FDA does have a rule that it doesn't enforce, which says you're not supposed to use the phrase on things that are naturally. So, yes. So, yes, you are seeing it. Not on bananas, but on just some snack foods. Or I saw one tea line, you know, it's like these lovely or juices, you know, just, you know, you're not trying to solve a problem, right? At PBFA, it was all about what, you know, animal product are you trying to displace in the marketplace? That's about, we were about solving problems, not just putting any random, you know, product on the market and calling it plant-based because it might sell. So there's definitely a lot of misuses of the phrase, but again, it happens every time any phrase in the market gets popular.
Okay, so the Plant-Based Food Association, under your leadership, came up with a definition of plant-based.
Correct.
And some people either don't know about it, the federal government doesn't have a definition of plant-based. The federal government has been struggling with the word natural.
Right.
And we have natural flavorings, which are a disaster.
Right, so, which is the good reason not to have the federal government involved in defining.
So when you go to someone like Tyson and say you're using this word and according to our definition, you're not following it, how does that work?
Well, there doesn't have to be a federal government definition or any legal definition per se for something to be deceptive. Right. What defines something as being deceptive is what the consumers think it means. Right. Same thing. You know, I've also been involved in lawsuits going after companies like Hormel and other meat companies for use humanely raised or natural chicken.
There's another one. Yeah.
Right. So the point is that the measure of what makes something deceptive in the marketplace is what is the message that consumers understand. Right. And it doesn't even have to be the majority of consumers. It's just a significant portion of consumers who see a phrase and understand it to mean a certain thing. And you're not doing that thing, then you are being deceptive. And right. So, you know, and so that's and yeah. So unfortunately, you know, litigation is often the way to sort of enforce these types of concepts because government agencies are asleep at the wheel.
I'm thinking of the happy cows. The images of the cows on the bucolic
pasture
farms. Yeah.
Right.
And I'm not sure where that ended up going.
It didn't go anywhere, but I mean, I think it was, I think it was done mostly for press and for, you know, sometimes groups file lawsuits just to kind of make a point in the in the public's eye that that whole Happy Cow campaign was, you know, obviously ridiculous, given that most cows are not raised on pasture. They're raised in really horrible factory farm conditions, you know, eating corn slop. So, you know, it made the point, but legally, I don't think they went anywhere. But the bottom line is plant-based should mean no animal ingredients. And that's easy enough to see by simply reading the ingredient panel.
Okay, back to how we got here.
Yes.
So I give a lot of credit to all of the people at the grassroots level who had the epiphany that we were eating animals and that that wasn't a good thing for numerous reasons. For me, I don't believe in killing any sentient being, period. I'm not into causing pain and suffering. And then I was delighted to learn that eating plants, whole food, minimally processed plants, were the best thing for my health and also were the best thing for the environment. It was win, win, win. And not everybody got that message. There was a growing movement. People didn't know what the word vegan meant, and then they did. And there's still some confusion, but there's a lot of good information out there. And then I guess in this world that we live in, companies or investors or people with ideas realized there was a new market, a market. And so first, I want to thank all the people that were involved in getting us to where we are here today, because it's not easy. And there've been a lot of books written on how to deal in society when you're not eating what everyone else is eating. We talk about Thanksgiving all the time and how difficult it is with families and children that realize who is on their plate and they don't want to eat them. All of this plays with our minds because our cultures, and I say cultures because there are many of them, and they all include eating animals somehow. We've been taught it's a good thing. And I was talking to Jim Mason a few weeks ago, the author of An Unnatural Order. I don't know if you read it, but it had a big impact on me in the 90s, and a new version has just come out. He goes back 10,000 years or more to say that we are here today because of decisions and things that happened back then. So there's a lot of layers here. But I want to give credit to all of us over the decades who had the strength to believe in our convictions and not exploiting animals and not exploiting human animals as well. It goes hand in hand. But there's a market now, and we live in a capitalistic society, and we don't want to slam capitalism. I know that gets.
Why not?
Well, we can. Sure, sure we can. Okay. Yeah. Let's slam capitalism. I don't like it. I think, If we're going to stick with capitalism, it needs to change. It needs to have a social component. We can't just base it on shareholder profits, period. Because yeah. We're seeing damage to the earth, damage to animals, damage to people. We're losing. Okay. But we have a lot of new products now because there's a market for vegans who want to eat like everybody else. Or... Right. The market thinks we do.
Right. Okay. So let me unpack some of that. You're right that those of us who've been in the plant-based food / vegan movement for decades deserve pretty much all, most of the credit for creating the opportunity that investors have now swooped into. Right. So, you know, and yet, like there seems to be a disconnect between, you know, sort of this real drive in the marketplace and where the movement started. And, you know, I think there's a couple of things going on. You know, obviously there have been companies that have been making alternatives to meat and dairy products for decades, but they were mostly targeting this niche market, right? And then kind of this next generation came along and realized, well, wait a minute, there seems to be this growing interest outside of just that niche market into what became called the flexitarian, right? People who are wanting to cut down on their meat and dairy products. I mean, you know, they were there all along, but they started to get more and more interested because of the work that so many of the, you know, advocacy organizations were doing to shine a light on all the problems of an animal-centered diet. And so, you know, but capitalism does what it does, which is to take a good idea and then exploit the hell out of it and, you know, take it to the nth degree. And so that's what we're seeing now. And what happens in the media is the media chases after whatever the sexy story is, right? So what's sexier than Silicon Valley investing hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars into these newfangled companies that are, oh my God, they're making, you know, meat out of plants, right? And, you know, I'm not putting that down. I spent a good chunk of my career promoting it. But to your point, it's like, you know, capitalism sees an opportunity and doesn't care about things like health or animals or the environment, but sees a tremendous economic opportunity. Now, you know, the entrepreneurs of many of these companies do care about the environment, especially. And so that's great. It's just that when the investment money starts pouring in, that can really change things, right? So then there's a trade-off between what started as a mission-oriented concept and, you know, business model, and then kind of can morph into something else. And so, you know, and then it also really changes the landscape of an industry. And so we're already seeing the impacts of that. So what's the dark side of this tremendous uptick in interest and success, really, of the plant-based foods industry, again, as defined by the alternatives? Well, the downside is you have now the likes of Tyson and Smithfield, you know, swooping in, taking up shelf space, really making it harder for certainly the smaller brands to compete. I mean, the, you know, very successful brands like Beyond and Impossible are solidly on shelf. But it's really kind of becoming a race between those two brands. And then, you know, these meat companies that are coming in, and then you have private label, and that's pretty much it, you know. So there is a trade-off when industry grows to a certain level of success. It attracts, you know, the likes of the biggest players in the market. You know, some are saying that's a good thing, right? You know, we want Tyson to make plant-based products. That means we've arrived. And what I say to that is, well, only that is only a good thing if Tyson is not, you know, or at least is displacing, you know, reducing their animal meat production, but there is no sign of that at all. In fact, quite the opposite. Tyson announced with its release of its new plant-based products not to worry, that they're still 100% committed to their animal baseline because they don't want to scare their investors. So, you know, I just think that the vegan movement needs to have eyes wide open and understand that, you know, what's happening to this industry sector is massive consolidation and a form of co-optation.
My focus has always been educating so people understand where we are today and they can make an informed decision, which I would like to think is a decision that does not support exploitation of people, animals, and the planet. And themselves. I will continue with that work because that's what I believe in. But we're seeing that some believe that we should just make products that people want to eat and people don't care what's in them. So if we make them from plants or man-made ingredients and not animals, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a good thing.
Yeah,
and, I know you're headed. And, so- and maybe over the decades, if we survive climate change and all those other problems that we have going on, maybe we'll arc and maybe we'll get there. Like with other technologies, it takes decades before they kind of infiltrate into society and we accept them and then they become mainstream. Maybe that'll happen, but do we really need to go that way? Right. All this money is being invested into these crazy products where we could just be investing in plant-based foods, real plant foods.
Oh, but Karen, there's no money to be made.
But there's no money to be made.
And quinoa. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there does seem to be this, the thinking goes something like this. people aren't going to eat whole foods, right? This is sort of this blanket statement that we hear all the time, you know, at least in
which is really insulting. And doctors have used that too. Oh, people don't need to know that. I'm sorry.
The arguments I hear are along the lines of only a small number of people are going to adopt a whole foods plant-based diet, and that we need to just give people what they want. They want meat, we need to give them meat. And yeah, you're right, whether it's made from plants or now, you know, this new biotech industry that's coming up behind plant-based. And it is a very cynical view of humanity. And I want to say, I think there's blame, if you want to use that word, to go around. I mean, let's be honest. many who promote a whole foods diet haven't exactly made it appealing. I mean, I was just talking to a colleague about this, you know, it's this sort of subsector, I guess, if you will, that talks about not even using salt, oil, or sugar, you know,
right. SOS free. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, if you wanted to pick the, you know, least appealing way to get people to adopt a way of eating, it would be to make it devoid of all flavor, right? And you know, so I understand if someone's like on death's door with heart disease or whatever, yeah, you got to take a drastic approach to diet. But, you know, most people really aren't in that position. And so I just think, you know, we have to take a little hard look at how even the whole foods plant-based sort of movement, if you will, is positioning itself. And that crowd needs to really like kind of get with the program and make it appealing and fun. I know there are people who do that. I'm not saying it's just true of everyone. There are some lovely chefs out there that are doing that. But okay, so that's that side of it, of the spectrum. But then on the other side, you're right. I definitely have a problem with this idea that we should just throw up our hands and, you know, people are too stupid. I mean, I've actually, you know, basically saying that people are too stupid, that they just want to keep eating meat, so just give them what they want. And, you know, it's a very, honestly, I think there are people in our movement that if they could, you know, sort of snap their fingers, they would just go in and replace all of the animal meat with, you know, either some version of plant-based or probably cell-based and not tell anyone. Like, I literally think there are people who think that would be a great idea if they could make it happen, because they think people are too stupid to notice, and who cares? They don't, you know, they don't even, and it's so cynical and dangerous on a number of levels. And I am not Pollyannish about this. I of course understand, because I made my own decision to promote, you know, many of these products, that people, you have to meet people where they are. And I am definitely in favor of that, but I never ever said these were products that people should eat all the time, or to the exclusion of, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and so forth. But I never really hear people that promote some of these products saying, oh, this is just a sometimes food, or this is a transition food. You know, if people in the medical community use the word transition food to describe some of these, you know, processed plant-based meat products, for example, I don't think I've ever heard the word transition uttered from a single company selling these products. Because of course, they don't want you to transition out of buying their products.
They want you to eat it forever. Yeah.
Keep eating it, eat more of it. Our shareholders or our investors will be happy the more you purchase our products. So, you know, and not to say there's anything wrong with that if you're trying to sell a product, that makes sense. But I think what we're talking about is how the sort of conversation about what it means to even eat a plant-based diet has sort of been, has shifted away from a whole foods plant-based diet, which is really health promoting, into this, you know, recreate every single animal product with, you know, either plants or now this biotech thing, which we should talk about, which is extremely troubling to me and is sort of the ultimate co-optation, really, of our movement. And, you know, it's problematic on a number of levels. So what we're talking about is, for example, cell-based animal meat. So, you know, taking cells from animals and then growing them in a lab setting and then somehow that becoming a meat product. Now it's very complicated, and companies haven't really, and they've only begun to, you know, sort of crack the code for how to do that, but it is coming, and it's already on the market, at least in one restaurant in Singapore, and companies are predicting it being on the market within a year or so here in the US. So it's something that we should absolutely be paying attention to. And I think is, in a word, crazy. Why would we recreate meat in a lab when we know that it is one of the, you know, most disease promoting foods out there? So, you know, and then of course the argument is, but this is what's going to get people to finally stop eating animals, right? And I actually don't even accept that argument.
I don't.
Not right. So it's funny to me because the argument sort of came from this idea again, well, people aren't going to stop eating meat, so we need to give them what they want, except for the slight problem of you still actually have to convince people to eat the cell-based meat, right? I mean, so again, because they can't just swap it out and not tell anyone, even though some of the folks who are promoting this technology would absolutely like to do that, you have to actually be honest with people about what the product is. So, you know, the same way, it's not automatic that you put a plant-based meat alternative on the market and people just adopt it, stop eating regular meat. The same challenge exists with the cell-based meat. And so the argument goes, as long as we make it taste the same or better, and as long as it's the same price or cheaper, of course people are just going to flock to this stuff. Because why would, and it's like, really? I don't see any evidence for it. And any of the consumer surveys that we might see about it are biased because they come from the sectors of the movement and the industry that have a vested interest in telling us that consumers will make this switch. So, you know, there's just, and then there's the other technology that is already on the market here, which is the synthetic biology created ice cream products, which contain a biotech version of whey protein made by a company called Perfect Day, which I just wrote an article about, which I think you read, and is causing a lot of confusion in the marketplace because companies don't know what to label it. It contains a dairy allergen, and the products are showing up on shelves that say plant-based. So that's another version of plant washing and co-optation of a phrase where it doesn't belong. So yeah, there's a lot happening, and a lot of it is not very good.
You mentioned ice cream, and I was just out at an ice cream store, and they had this marquee advertising all the different foods, and I was very confused. They listed some things as vegan, some things as non-dairy, some things as plant-based. And when I dug deeper, I found out that the plant-based does have this whey protein you're talking about, which can be really scary for people who can't consume that and don't realize that it's in there because it says plant-based. I want to say, I don't think people are stupid either, but we are all very influenced and heavily manipulated by marketing. And as I mentioned in the beginning of the program, how did we get here and the history with talking to different people? And I just remember with bread, for example, the history of bread. We have been marketed to believe that we started with these heavy whole food, high fiber grain breads. And then the wealthier people were eating this highly refined white bread. And it just seemed like that was the ideal product. It was more hygienic. And then we learned it had no nutrients in it. And we had to add more vitamins back into it. And right. and that was marketed. And then everybody started eating it because they thought it was better. And then we got back to realizing, oh no, the high fiber whole grain breads are better. And it's about the information that we're given. And most people, they're busy. They have all kinds of things to do. They don't have time to do what you do. They don't have time to do what I do. And and they just don't know. And this is where marketing comes in and where it's so dangerous. So these investors and these entrepreneurs and these biotech companies, they're making products and they're going to heavily market to convince people this is what they want to eat instead of heavily marketing people to eat the right food.
Yeah, I totally agree. It is all about the marketing. And it also is even about the food supply. So your white bread example made me think of one of my favorite examples of sort of technology gone wrong is trans fat. So, in the wake of
Exactly.
a turn away from butter, trans fats were introduced into the food supply in massive quantities. It really took over the cooking oils of the fast food companies, and then as an additive in pretty much every processed food on the market. And then, of course, what happened a couple of decades into this experiment, we found out, oh my God, trans fat also causes heart disease. And the FDA took, another 10 years to finally say, yeah, this was a mistake and we should really move it from the market because it's killing people. And so then the food industry had to like do a 180 and figure out how to undo all of the harm they did by getting trans fat out of the food supply. And I mean, and so this is the thing. It's like we really don't know what the unintended consequences are sometimes until it's too late, or at least until many, many people are harmed. And so the hubris of, in the case of, the biotech foods, creating entirely new categories of food. I mean, this isn't even just like an ingredient. It's like GMOs on steroids to me. This isn't just, and of course, it is much of it is using genetically engineered technology. The synthetic biology, the biotech way is using GMO technology, but they don't want to call it that. There are all kinds of euphemisms. I read another article talking about the greenwashing of with the phrase alternative proteins, which is the phrase du jour now to sort of incorporate all of this. And within that, we have all kinds of euphemism like cultivated meat now is the phrase instead of clean meat, which it was before when it's really biotech meat. And then the euphemism now for the genetically engineered whey or dairy and egg products that we're seeing come up is fermentation, right? As if we're eating tempeh or kombucha, right? So it's really important to pay attention to this language because it's a deliberate way to obfuscate. And I spent my whole career, unpacking how corporations use language to confuse consumers. And it's sad, is the devastatingly sad to me to see these same underhanded, deceptive tactics being used. The types of tactics that I've tracked for years by the likes of Monsanto and McDonald's are now being adopted by companies who are saying, we want to save the planet and save animals. And I think because of that positioning, which some of them do, I'm not questioning their motives, I am questioning their tactics. They are doing this in a way that is really not good for the consumer and not transparent. And just because you're trying to save animals does not give you the right to use deceptive tactics, right? And so I think it really behooves the vegan movement to pay close attention. And this is, why I'm writing these articles is because I'm seeing so much sort of blind cheerleading for this technology, just for anything that appears like it might save an animal or two, when we have zero evidence that these techniques will save animals. And something I want to pick up on too that you said about, it's insulting to people to say that we just need to give them what they want. I think there's a huge opportunity cost as well in not encouraging people to open their eyes to the entirety of what's wrong with our food system, right? Just replacing an ingredient. Now, I call it ingredient-based activism, whether it was trans fat or then it was to get high fructose corn syrup. It's ridiculous. We cannot solve the problem of the food system by simply replacing an ingredient. I mean, that's what this is. It's just a bigger version of that. And meanwhile, the system remains in place, right? Workers at meat plants die every day or get maimed. And there's no evidence that this strategy will work. A. B, we're not dismantling any of the, capitalist run amok problems of the entire food system. And in the meantime, we're not giving people the opportunity to wake up and say, oh my God, these issues are all connected and I'm participating in it. How can I change not only the way I eat fundamentally, but how can I then become an activist for changing the rest of the world, right? I mean, imagine like if when we started out, right, some 20, 30 years ago, this was the strategy, well, we wouldn't have become who we are today. I mean, think about that a lot. Like, you know, many people have told me that I've inspired them. Well, if I just, you know, started eating biotech meat back in 1996, I wouldn't have written my book. You know what I mean? It's like, we need to go deeper and not just treat people like sheep and, or, you know, whatever the, you know, animal friendly version is of that phrase. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, I feel like we are missing an opportunity to really create a movement of people who will connect the dots and care not just animals or even just about the environment, but all of it, because it is all connected.
Beautiful. I'm just going to take that in. I am totally with you. It never made sense to me to focus on a single campaign, a single issue. I always like to pull back and say, wait a minute, these are all symptoms of a bigger problem. How do we solve the whole problem? But right. That seems too difficult.
I understand.
Too difficult to raise money for that, to get people excited.
And that way of thinking will always make that so.
Yeah. Right?
So like someone just asked me on social media, well, why do we have this reductionist view of nutrition, for example? And I said, all of activism is reductionist. And she said, why? I said, in a word, funding, right? Because funders want, will only fund, you know, these particular issues. And so NGOs, you know, answer to funders. And it's a very stupid system. I mean, even the 501c3 model is insane because, you know, you're limited in how you can lobby. And yet that's the only way to get tax deductible donation. I mean, it's like, you know, talk about operating with one hand, it's operating with two hands tied behind your back. I mean, so I think we really need to question these models of advocacy that have been built up and say, well, wait, maybe there's a reason we have, I mean, a gazillion 501c3 organizations that aren't really getting to the heart of the problem. Well, I mean, part of the reason is they can't under that particular business model.
Exactly.
Right? If your only business model is education and 15% of your funds can go to lobbying, well, then you can't just fix 15% of the problem, right? So, I mean, and I understand that it's hard, but there are other models of activism that we could be engaging in. And I think it's time to really broaden our scope and talk to people, for example, in the labor movement. I mean, we haven't even really talked about workers. I just find it completely unethical to be lifting up the likes of Tyson, which many in the vegan movement do, while that company is, and the other meat packing companies are directly responsible for the deaths of untold workers during the pandemic. And of course, besides, and you know, I always think of like the families who've lost loved ones or whose family members are still suffering, and what they must think if they were to see the latest, you know, celebration by vegans of, you know, Tyson, Smithfield, you name it. And so I think it is incumbent upon us. It's not to say that, you know, every group has to work on labor issues. It's that when you celebrate Tyson, you are undermining the ability of groups who are trying to get Tyson to stop hurting workers and animals. So, you know, that's the piece that I think people aren't connecting, that, you know, it's like, when I think about back in the day, do you remember when Philip Morris was donating, you know, to like the Virginia Slims tennis tournament? Well, obviously that was their way of, you know, distracting from, I had a whole chapter in my book about, you know, the use of philanthropy to buy silence and distract activists from, it's like, it's even worse than that. As far as I know, Tyson isn't actually donating money to these vegan groups. And yet these vegan groups are celebrating them. You know, they're like free ambassadors of the Tyson brand. I mean, not that it would be better if they were being paid. You see what I'm saying? It's like, not only are they being silent, they're actually becoming advertisers for a horrific, horrific company. And that's just one example. So I'm just saying, I really want people to open their eyes, pay attention to what's going on, and to question, and to simply ask questions. Like, is this really the right path? What is a better path? What are some alternative business models here where we can really think more holistically about this movement?
Michelle Simon, thank you so much. We are at the end of the hour, and I know we could go on and talk about this because it's a big problem and we have a lot of work to do, but I thank you for your clarity, for your honesty, for telling the truth, and for your courage.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you. And thank
okay,
you
we will talk more another time.
Okay. Sounds good, Karen.
Thanks
thank
again.
You. Really
Take
enjoyed
care.
It. Okay, right. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Michelle Simon, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Let's keep it going. You can send me an email at info@realmeals.org with your comments, your ideas. We're all in this together. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.